You love keeping secrets. Anyway, so I didn't know whether we would be outside or inside this morning, so I don't have slides. I'm dressed like a dirt bag because I thought we might be outside, but that has not proven to be the case. So you love keeping secrets. When I was a youth pastor, you wouldn't tell me who in my youth group was getting baptized. He loves it. All right. Well, last year, a man who was very important to our church and to whom our church is quite indebted, died. And I believe that we mentioned his passing on a Sunday morning at some point. I can't remember if it was directly after he passed or not. But many of us would probably not have taken the time to notice it otherwise. And from the books and articles that he wrote to the countless summers at Summit Ministries, where he molded young people, to the lectures at Hillsdale, where he taught, and even to the very church, to our very church, where he gave several talks over the years, Dr. Michael Bauman was formative in my life and many of you sitting here today, that of many of you sitting here today. Some of you, upon hearing his name, might flinch a bit as you found him prickly or taciturn or generally just not your cup of tea, and I understand that. Dr. Bauman would be okay with that, I think. He styled his teaching and disposition after C.S. Lewis's bulldog of a tutor, William Kirkpatrick. And Kirkpatrick was you might call him a bare-knuckle brawler in the arena of argumentation, linguistic precision, and rhetoric. He refused to allow lazy words and reckless thinking from his pupils, and Dr. Bauman self-confessedly sought to emulate how Kirkpatrick taught. Above all, both of these men valued truth. If their pupils thought them to be inhospitable curs or unkind drill sergeants, so what? Could those sitting under their tutelage think and speak clearly and exactly, all the while pursuing truth? If so, then they had succeeded. And no one sitting in a lecture from Dr. Bauman was safe, mostly because no one at all among us sitting in on his lectures had flawless thinking on every topic. If you opened your mouth, you'd need to be ready to have every hole conceivable poked in your words and your argument. Some of you may remember this sort of Socratic questioning happening even at our church on a Sunday morning, which is an odd place for it, but that so was his insistence on that methodology, that even during a Sunday morning service, he was, I recall him with, if many of you remember, Ed and Dottie Powell sitting right up front, him just going back and forth with Dottie Powell in a very animated way on a Sunday morning. So fascinating. His goal was never argument for argument's sake, I don't think. It was never to degrade or demean anyone. It was simply to clear away the barriers of people's thought and speech that kept them from more fully knowing the God of the universe. And most of the time, at least in my estimation, Dr. Bauman offended people's sensibilities for two reasons. A minority of the time, he was cantankerous and uncharitable, but we all are. The two main reasons, though, I think, was that he cared more about truth than making people uncomfortable. And I think secondly, and we would all probably agree with this, that most folks are too easily offended. And just as an aside, the word itself, I wish we could just strike from our popular lexicon. It is such an abused and misused word that it seems to be devoid of meaning these days. But that's another topic for another time. Dr. Bauman once wrote, he said, and this was in an essay entitled, I believe, The Theology of Invective, so you can tell where this is going, but he said, "I can see no other way. We must learn to confront nonsense in all its forms and to call things by their real names. We must learn that euphemisms are lies and that patience, tolerance, and gentleness sometimes do no good. Worse still, they often do injury. Count on it. When you treat a fool with nothing but kindness, he remains a fool. If you pat him on the back and stroke his ego, he does what any fool does. He mistakenly concludes that everything is all right with him, rather than realizing you are simply being kind to ignorance the way you are kind to all other forms of poverty. we must revive the ancient and honorable art of invective, which is to language what justice is to law, a means of giving people what they deserve. What some of them deserve is a good kick in the pants. You can see why he and Wendell were actually very good friends over the years. And I think he's right that, and this is not directed merely outwardly at others, but certainly to ourselves, we could all use a swift kick in the pants, and so could everyone else from time to time. So his words seem harsh, but are they really? I don't think so. If there was ever a culture and a people that might be accused of being too nice, of being nicer than Jesus, as we have said in this church many times, of being accommodating instead of calling out error and sin, of being polite first and truth conscious second, I think it would be our own. Perhaps it's our affluence. Maybe it's our false sense of security. Maybe it's our pseudo-Christian veneer or the residue of Christianity that hasn't quite washed off of our culture yet, that's clinging on from decades past. But whatever the reason is, it seems to be present. And so when you look at the writings and lives of Christians who have preceded us, you get the feeling like their commitment to Christ is a bit more all-encompassing, whereas ours may not be. It is his phrase, Dr. Bauman's phrase, "We must learn to call things by their real names," that has always stuck with me. Ever since I heard it, it's probably been almost 20 years ago now that I first heard him say that, and it has been reiterated in his writings. It grabs my attention most in everything that I've read and heard from him. We are a people who decidedly do not call things by their real names, but of course his point is that we ought to. So here's the train of thought, and it seems to me to be a biblical train of thought. You must clearly speak, and in order to think clearly, you must be able to think clearly, that is, objectively, to begin to grasp how God has made reality. Pretty simple. Thus, to call things by their real names, to speak accurately and circumspectly about the world in which God has placed us, is to draw oneself closer to truth and thus closer to God, the one who said, "I am truth." And as the Gospel of John tells us, to know the truth is to be a real disciple of Jesus's and to be set free, which we want. And is this not one of the chief reasons we are drawn to the man Jesus in the Gospels? Think about why, amongst his miracle working, amongst his resurrection, and amongst everything else you can think about Jesus as you survey the Gospels, think about what is it that draws you to him. There are countless stories from our own congregation and anecdotally from men and women whom we might read and listen to about this sort of gravitational force or pull that Jesus has as we look into his words in the Gospels. William Lane Craig talks about that being I think he calls it just Jesus is captivating, as he read through the New Testament for the first time, how he was just captivated by the what this man was going around saying. Not that he was going around saying unnecessarily shocking things, but the way in which he conducted himself is unique in history, seemingly. And does it not serve as the impetus to look fervently into all of Jesus' dealings and teachings and life as a whole? Jesus called things by their real names. I think that is one of the main reasons we're drawn to him. He said faith was exemplary when it came from Samaritans and Romans and tax collectors and prostitutes. He publicly identified hypocrisy and sin when it stemmed from the most powerful Jews of the time, the Pharisees, Sadducees, scribes, and teachers of the law. He redefined God's kingdom not to be a political overthrow, as we know, of the government, but an inbreaking of salvation and healing and repentance. And I don't know about you, but I'm drawn to Jesus in part for how he chose the right word at the right time to accomplish the right thing. And of course, he's God, so that's not surprising. But when we seek to emulate him, so much of what we're seeking to emulate is saying the right word at the right time to accomplish the right thing. He spoke forthrightly to everyone that he met, did he not? If a person needed a word of encouragement, he gave it. If one of rebuke, he gave that. If one of clarification, he gave that. In all of his interactions, and above all else, however, he was truthful. Hardly surprising from he who was and is the embodiment of truth. it must be a draw of the gospel accounts in this day and age that we read of Jesus speaking in a manner so wholly different to those around us. And perhaps that's the main draw, is the juxtaposition between how we and our culture talk and how Jesus talked to those around him in first century Palestine. We so often talk to one another in platitudes and half-baked aphorisms and with divided attention. Our tone is frequently sarcastic or condescending. We are impatient, imprecise, and rushed. And when those with whom we speak would be so grateful, I mean, really so grateful for long-suffering, succinctness, or abiding concern in our words and actions. We think of the woman at Jacob's well, or the rich young ruler, or Nicodemus, or the disciples on so many occasions we lose count, or Pontius Pilate, or nearly everyone with whom we have record of Jesus interacting is reoriented by him, by Jesus, in a more truthful direction. You think of all of the ways in which people came to Jesus, and you see them leave from his influence and care even more directed towards and set on a trajectory towards truth and God's kingdom. Sorry, I lost my place here. So this was not pleasant for any of them, or easy for any of them, as we might expect, any of the people with whom he interacted. But it is what God knew they desperately needed. And has that really changed with those around us today? Obviously it hasn't. Isn't the urgency to be courageous and forthright with the gospel, describing the world and people as they really, truly are, just as acute now as it was 2,000 years ago? Well, obviously so. As believers, language is a tool in our arsenal that can be used effectively to further the gospel, or it could serve as an impediment to non-Christians. We all know folks, and perhaps some of us have done it ourselves, who have used words as an instrument of abuse and a cudgel rather than weaving them together in such an inviting way so as to make Christianity more attractive. I just finished reading a biography, or kind of a biography, about Christopher Hitchens, the notorious atheist. If you ever care to read it, it's by a gentleman named Larry Taunton, and it's called The Faith of Christopher Hitchens. It's a fascinating book. It's about the latter stages of his life, where he was dying of cancer and in conversation with many Christians, which was interesting. But Christopher Hitchens, if you've ever listened to the man, if you've ever listened to a debate of his or heard him speak on a particular program, he's no stranger to the nuance of English. For all the things you might say negative about him, he had a way with words. Hitchens discovered at a young age that he was very unathletic and didn't fit in with the boys at school and was often bullied. And so he had little physical ability to defend himself, but he could adroitly use words as a defense and even as a weapon. Hitchens made it clear that his rhetorical flourish and the flowery speeches that he made were rarely, however, in pursuit of truth and almost always in service to cultivating a particular public image. And this is why we must all have a heart for truth and ever be enhancing the way we speak and think. Expanding your vocabulary and thinking in new terms should never be about appearing more impressive, as it was for Christopher, but it should be about expanding your arsenal. The more words and concepts at your disposal, the more accurately you can think and speak and understand the needs of others. It's not an exercise in grandstanding, it's an exercise in putting more tools in your tool chest. The more our linguistic horizons broaden, the more the world God has gifted us opens up to inquiry and appreciation, I think. We live in a time of linguistic opacity. Words and phrases are bandied about in such a way that it's hard to have a conversation about profound ideas. Words like God, the Bible, love, sin, human even, world, and truth have been so warped and changed that agreeing on definitions is often the first step in sharing and living the teachings of Scripture. To begin to address this, I think it all starts with us, right? To get our own houses in order. How often do we as believers fail to call things by their real names? We'll talk about the insidiousness of euphemism in a moment, but how many times have you or I excused away sin in our lives by calling it something other than what it really is? How many times have we mentally chalked up the wickedness of jealousy and avarice to just maybe being ambitious? How often have we excused the perniciousness of disgusting pornographic infidelity to something like lust or slipping up? I have more vivid descriptions here to drive home the point, but we don't have Sunday school till next week, and so there are children in here, so I'll keep it, the rest of it, PG-13 rather than R. So the long and short of it is that just as Jesus unabashedly called sin what it is, so too we must in our own lives. Is not all sin just self-aggrandizing cosmic treason? Is it not some sort of hubristic evil act of will that jettisons the wishes of the Almighty in favor for our own short-sighted idiocy? The next time we're tempted to contemplate our sin as anything other than in the most florid and depraved terms, consider whether we have called it by its real name. I find myself doing this often when I'm rehashing the day and thinking about the numerous ways in which I failed or screwed up. I often will brush aside things with my own thinking, and it's a discredit to it. If you go ask God for forgiveness for something that you have marginalized in your own speech and thought, and lie to yourself about it, the forgiveness that he offers is not as overwhelming, and thus your gratitude probably isn't either. On the flip side, we have to do everything in our power to think and speak of all that is good and righteous around us accurately. Paul talks about this in Philippians. The good news of salvation contrasts resplendently against the backdrop of humanity's true moral guilt. The intricately woven story of the scriptures is not only the greatest story that has been told, it is, as I mentioned before, as Alvin Plantinga says, the greatest story that ever could be told. The distinction, again, is between the greatest story ever told and one that could be told. I truly cannot and have never been able to think of anything more grand and amazing than the Christian narrative. I think this is what draws many of us to the works of people like Lewis and Tolkien and so forth, that they galvanize the normal pedestrian moments of human existence so often with ennobling and grandiose and regal language. As I've mentioned before, this practice is actually at the heart of why I don't read fiction very often, but probably ought to, because Kerry Warren is probably looking at me very accusatively, and I should. But as we've talked about before, our lives, if they're couched in the right thought and word choice, are more preposterous and remarkable than anything from Lord of the Rings or Narnia. And I know those two things aren't mutually exclusive, but truly it is. Every moment is suffused with infinite significance. We talk about this all the time. The perils we encounter are more treacherous than the most wicked, powerful villains of fantasy. And the heroic deeds done by image bearers of the divine on this earth outstrip those counterparts in the realm of make-believe every single time. We lie to ourselves when we don't speak and think clearly upon waking up each day. Do we tell ourselves, this is a normal day and my conduct will be of little consequence? Do we tell ourselves that explicitly or implicitly? Or do we tell ourselves, it's not a normal day? No such thing exists. Today's a gift. I've been placed on a battlefield and I'm fighting for a just cause. My dealings with God and other people today have seismic, earth-shattering implications. I'm cared for by the one God of the universe, and he has given me every good thing and more that I could possibly need. We simply must speak and think clearly, as we cannot count on others to do the same. Richard Mitchell writes, "Slovenly language makes slovenly thought possible." And there's a lot of both in our world right now. Our culture's penchant to co-opt words and to hijack definitions is incredible. I probably don't need to tell you that. Terms like love are often employed to mean fleeting feelings of wanting to be with someone else, but rarely refer to doing what is best for one another. Words like racism are now almost completely emptied of all intelligible meaning. If you've argued the pro-life position, you know that a concept seemingly as uncontroversial as a person can become a helpless victim of the worst kind of linguistic sorcery or gymnastics. The problem is no different now than it was in first century Galilee. Jesus had to patiently remind his Jewish interlocutors that their understanding of concepts like marriage, lust, hate, repentance, piety, and so on, that they had cultivated for hundreds and hundreds of years, were incorrect. His parable of the Good Samaritan is preceded by a self-justifying lawyer condescendingly asking the question, "Who is my neighbor?" and not in a genuine way. When Jesus finishes his story and asks the lawyer who proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers, we all know the lawyer's response. And he responds with perhaps, I would call it, the most egregious act of circumlocution in perhaps all of literature, a man who is hell-bent on talking around the answer rather than giving it. He says, the lawyer says to Jesus, the one who showed him mercy. He could not even bring himself to call the Samaritan what he truly was, a good neighbor and a real Samaritan. As believers, we cannot hide behind this sort of sloppy language or omission. Paul tells us in Ephesians 5 to have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but to rather expose them. If we are to expose evil to light, it starts with describing wickedness fully and truthfully. In our minds and in our conversations, sin is often allowed to live on the periphery of language. Since all evil is a mere twist or perversion of something good, its true home is at the edge and never at the center of discourse. When dealt with directly and succinctly, it withers under scrutiny. That's the nature of sin. Rationalizations and redefinitions and obfuscation and sarcasm and euphemism are all tools that we and others use to hide the true nature and magnitude of sin. And don't we all know this deep down, even though sometimes we employ those things? Don't we all tire of those around us who explain away all their shortcomings and are purposely opaque in their speech, or whose lips are dripping with sarcasm all the time? Don't we tire of that in ourselves? I recall in my late teens being so sarcastic that I wasn't sure what I actually thought about certain subjects anymore because I had spoken about them sarcastically for so long. I was jaded and contrarian. Again, we are drawn to Jesus because he was clear and direct in what he said and did. While his opponents may have often used language to entrap and accuse him, think of all the times that teachers of the law and Pharisees approached him with a plan to ensnare him with their language and their clever questioning, and Jesus, of course, adeptly sidesteps it and gets to the heart of the matter. Jesus used language instead to illuminate and to clear a way for truth. It wouldn't be a sermon of mine without G.K. Chesterton. He inveighed against the burgeoning eugenics and birth control movements at the turn of the 20th century. And he said, "We are not entitled to despair of explaining truth, nor is it so horribly difficult to explain." I'll read that again. "We are not entitled to despair of explaining the truth, nor is it so horribly difficult to explain." And if you could characterize Jesus's speech and his dialogue with others, it would be that he was persistent and dogged in declaring truth and did not despair. That's for sure. The challenge Chesterton comes in what he calls the contemporary weakness for euphemism. The weakness for euphemism. It's one of my favorite phrases. He writes of the birth control movement. He says this. Again, this was written, I believe, 1905, 1910, sometime around there. He says, "The phrase they use is always softened and suited for journalistic appeals. They talk of free love when they mean something quite different, better defined as free lust. They feel bound to simper and coo over the word love. They insist on talking about birth control when they mean less birth and no control. We could smash them to atoms if we could be as indecent in our language as they are immoral in their conclusions. Read that last line one more time. We could smash them to atoms if we could be as indecent in our language as they are immoral in their conclusions. Again, evil hides on the periphery of language. We must drag it, kicking and screaming, into the light of truth, where it will wither and die. To hell with the phrase reproductive rights. To hell with that phrase, right? It conceals beneath it the bloody, barbarous dismemberment of hundreds of millions of defenseless babies. To hell with calling every perverse, disgusting sexual amalgam between people love. It makes a mockery of the God-ordained institutions and relationships that can truly produce genuine love and are its only home. To hell with calling men women and women men. And to hell with calling our own sin anything other than what it actually is, a malevolent poison of our own making that nailed our Lord to the cross. Condemn those things, condemn those phrases, those terrible phrases that cover up for a multitude of sin to the pits of hell. Greg. The more we misname sin, the more we allow it to fester and spread, the more we correctly identify it, the faster it can be eradicated. On some level, if we can rightly name a thing, then we know a great deal about that thing. We don't necessarily share that penchant for naming things properly and contemplatively in our culture. I'm sure Josh could talk for a half hour on Middle Eastern sensibilities related to names, right? What do names mean? What do they encapsulate? What do they tell you about a person rather than just the sound that you make when you call someone, right? As most parents do, Janelle and I have been going back and forth for months about what our son's name should be. My strategy, as is Andrew Bernard's strategy from The Office, is to wear her down and to get my way through personality mirroring and name repetition. And I think I'm succeeding in this. We're drawing closer to the time of the full term, and she seems to be just giving up. So we'll see. I'll let you know how that goes. It'll be decided on the birth certificate, I guess. But a good deal of my eagerness to settle on a name stems from wanting to identify my son more fully. When I talk to him, I call him Buddy or Big Guy or whatever. But if I could refer to him by his name, by the name I want, Alistair, if I could refer to him as Alistair, which maybe we'll just hash it out after the service here, but then that changes things a great deal. It might seem just a formality, but it does change things a great deal, I think. Suddenly, I know him in a way that I did not previously. And perhaps it's a bygone thing, since we give very little thought to naming our children, our pets, and whatever else these days, but perhaps it's a wise exercise to ruminate longer on what things really are and what they should be called. If I can call my son Alistair, and Alistair means defender of all mankind, are you kidding me with that? Defender of all mankind, and she doesn't like that name? Anyway, I picture him with a sword and a shield in the womb, ready to get out and start fighting. It's so great. But anyway, he probably doesn't have a shield in there. I think naming conventions and even just thinking about the etymology of our names, our last names in particular, that those are, you know, in the past tied to professions or to, you know, all sorts of different things and that's, to be honest, I think that's part of the appeal of going to somewhere like the Genealogy Center and the library downtown is that to explore those sort of things and where our names came from, where we came from. But at any rate, to close, perhaps Dr. Bauman was giving us a profoundly biblical principle when he spoke of our duty to call things by their real names. In our own thinking and speaking, as well as conversationally with others, this will never be easy to do. But if we care deeply about the truth and the gospel, well, we are certainly obliged to do this. Thank you.
Yeah, you're supposed to do. You're supposed to.